It's the All Things Strange Podcast. We are your hosts, Agent Anderson and
Agent ETA.
Come along as we examine UFO sightings, conspiracies, and all things strange. You can find all of our wonderful links in the description on the Linktree, where you can find our Discord, our Patreon, our merchandise, and more. This week's episode, Bernie Madoff. Is that weird? You can't hear the music, so it's...
Actually, I could. No, I could. Huh. I could hear the music that time, yeah.
Oh, weird.
I don't know what changed. Something changed.
Nothing that I'm aware of, but hey, who the hell knows? Well, it's... Well, good for that. As chosen by our Patreon subscribers, we've got three wonderful tiers for everybody. The first tier will get you early access and after hours. The next tier, bonus episodes. And finally, the ability to vote on upcoming topics. Like this one, Bernie Madoff. They voted on this one over a UFO case, over a crash retrieval in Arizona. Really? I was kind of surprised by that, but hey, you never know. They're always surprising me on what they choose for the next topic, but it's always something fun to do anyways. All right.
Well, this was a huge case in its time. I mean, yeah. It still is, you know, but like it was a big deal. A lot of people lost their ass financially because of this guy.
A lot of
his
people.
Ponzi scheme. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, you're definitely going to have to do some of the heavy lifting here because I just don't understand that market, like stocks and trades and everything. Like I'm kind of what would you call it? A peasant when it comes to this kind of information,
Yeah.
I understand a little bit of it, but a lot of the, even some of the terms that people use when describing these situations, like what's going on? What is that? What does that mean?
The case is simpler than you think it is. So, but we'll get into some of that, but we don't actually for this one, you don't really need too much fancy stuff. I mean, you could get into the weeds, but I chose not to. So I kept it kind of simple in my notes.
Yeah. And it all like pretty much like the Ponzi scheme all kind of circles around his asset management business, right? That he was trying to keep low key and stuff, right?
Yeah. I'll get into that a little bit and what exactly is a Ponzi scheme. I'll get into all that stuff at some point. But I guess, well, let's start at the beginning. Bernie Madoff. Who was he? What did he do? Get him out of my face.
Buttered sausages. What is it? What does it do? Yeah. Get it out of my face. I don't buy jam. I buy honey and I kiss it on the lips.
Exactly. I don't know why, man. That one, I never get tired of that one.
It's like, I have to watch that clip every once in a while. So I don't know why. I couldn't tell you.
It's so good. Also, apologies for everybody. I will use my noise removal stuff. But my dogs are going absolutely berserk for some reason. As soon as I hit record, boom, they start going
all
nuts.
Of a sudden, right?
Yeah, all of a sudden. I don't know what the deal is, but apologies. Hopefully it's not too bad for those of you listening. All right.
How's your new dog doing?
Oh, and the new dog is doing really, really well. Where is she?
He's getting along with everybody?
Yeah, it's a she. I think she's...
Or she? Okay.
I think she's out there causing a ruckus. She was on the couch earlier right behind me, but... She'll probably wander back in here at some point, and then Adrian Ether will get home from the gym, and then she'll wander away again. That's where she's right now. She's at the gym, and she had OT today, so she didn't have time to do any sort of research or anything whatsoever. She didn't. I said, "Hey, just come on and have a chat." Anyways, she's like, "Nah, all right, it's cool, it's all good."
Yeah, whatever.
Yeah, but anyway, so let's start at the beginning. Bernie Madoff was born on April 29th, 1938. In Queens, New York. And immediately right there, if you're not thinking of coming to America, then what's wrong with you? You know, phenomenal movie. But anyways, let's not get into that tangent. he goes to Queens because that's where he thinks he's going to find a queen. It's so stupid. Also hilarious. Anyways, his father, Bernie's father, was a plumber and a stockbroker. Wow. Okay. So it's quite the combination there. It's a very bizarre combination, but it actually struck me. based on the plumbers that I've met and the financial shenanigans we've read about on Wall Street, this is like the perfect combination of, you know, a fraudulent or shyster or however you want to say it, like just basically a shitter who's going to rip people off. Have you ever called a plumber, ETA?
No, I've always kind of taken care of my own plumbing issues, just because it's one of those things where I'm not an expert in it, but I find it simple enough to where, like, if somebody else can do it, I can do it too. I used to be a diesel mechanic, so there, you know, I can work well with my hands and stuff. You know, I know how to fix certain things, or at least how to learn how to fix things. You know, so I've never wanted to. I have the only one time I did call a plumber and hire a plumber was to install one of those water softeners on my house. Just because I figured, like, you know, I was like, I don't know. I bought the water softener and stuff, and I was like, I don't know exactly how to route this. So, you know what? I'm just going to wave the F flag this time and pay somebody to do it, and just to make sure it gets done right. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So that's the only time I've ever hired a plumber. But it was, you know, the guy did a good job. You know, he soldered the copper pipe together very well. And I know how to solder copper pipe. I've done it before. But, he definitely was a little cleaner than I probably would have done it, you know? So I didn't regret hiring the guy. He did a good job. So
every time I hire a plumber, I feel like I'm getting mugged. I'll just leave it at that. I just stopped calling them. Like, I'm just doing it myself. I don't know how to do this, but I'll figure it out because I can't afford to pay $500 to fix a leak. Like, it's just, maybe there's a difference cheap between the plumbers here and the plumbers where you are. I don't know, but the plumbers where I'm at, I feel like I'm talking to a car salesman every time I call one. So I stopped doing it.
Oh, really?
But anyways, the point being that from my perspective, being a plumber and a stockbroker, I'm starting to see the apple doesn't fall too far from the tree here, you know, is what I'm kind of getting at there. Fast forward a little bit. He married his high school sweetheart. She's a sort of a minor player in this affair, but I'm not going to talk about her very much. And he graduated in 1960 from college with a degree in political science. I was not expecting political science. I was expecting something having to do with finance, but no, political science. Mm-hmm. He went to law school for a year, but left to found Bernard L. Madoff Investment Securities, LLC in 1960.
He was also a little side note there. He was also he worked as a lifeguard at the beach for a little bit.
Yeah, and installing like sprinklers or something, sprinkler systems. Uh-huh. That's actually how he earned his little initial $5,000 to start his company. Oh, also $50,000 from his father-in-law, which in today's money, did I look that up? $50,000
back then. That was a good sum of money. You know.
Yeah. I think that's about, how much is that? So I don't know. It's a lot. It's probably about 500,000 today. It's a butt ton. So I wish I had a father-in-law to be like, hey, oh, you're starting a business. Here's $500,000. There you go, buddy.
Hey, there you go. Yeah. Have a good time, man.
Try not to spend it all in one place, right? The basic idea of his LLC was that it was a broker dealer for penny stocks. It was a small-time operation, at least at first. And so what a broker-dealer is it's a catch-all term for a company that trades for either its own account or on behalf of others. So he started that, and he got a $50,000 loan or whatever from his father-in-law, Saul Alpern, who was an accountant, actually. And he's sort of an important figure because Saul Alpern and his accounting firm referred a lot of clients to Bernie early on for his investment side of things. So his company always had basically two sides to the company. There was the side that was basically doing market type activities, market making type stuff. And then there was the other side that handled investments for people. So two different parts of the same company. So the part where he invested money for people, a lot of his initial clients came from his father-in-law, and it looked legit from the beginning. Yeah, we're going to say something, ETA?
No, I'm just saying,
So the first task he did with his legitimate side of his business was a market maker for the Pink Sheets. So Pink Sheets, that's the over-the-counter for penny stocks. It's done a little differently than, you know, the big, like Microsoft does not trade on the Pink Sheets. I don't want to get into all the details and that stuff because it doesn't really matter that much for this case. It's just he started small, is the point. But one of the important things he did was he was an early adopter of computer technology in order to compete with the bigger companies on the New York Stock Exchange. So he bought computers and figured out how to run them, or I'm sure he hired people to figure out how to run them to do trades. And this system was a big part of what eventually became the National Association of Securities Dealers Automated Quotations Stock Market, or the NASDAQ. Yes, that NASDAQ exchange. He didn't invent it, but he definitely contributed to it a decent amount.
He was on the ground floor when it became a thing.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Which is actually pretty impressive. Like some of the the dealings and goings on that he was involved with throughout his career are actually pretty impressive. Like the guy has a lot of accolades and a lot of stuff that he was involved in that, the guy was an extremely influential person throughout his career. You know, he accomplished quite a bit while also ripping people off.
Well, and that's the strange thing is the legitimate side of his business was very successful. At one point, they were the largest market maker on the NASDAQ. And in 2008, just a random statistic I found, it was the sixth largest on the S&P 500. We're talking about a lot of volume going through his exchanges. He was making good money on that part of the business. He didn't need to rip people off to make money. He was doing really good.
That's kind of one of the things that really strikes me as strange as far as like this behavior that he ended up being exposed upon, you know, what he did as far as ripping people off and stuff. He was successful enough, you know, with just the legitimate stuff that he was doing. Like, he would have still been wealthy and been very successful if he had just kept to legitimate business dealings, you know, but he had to push it, you know, he had to do more, you know?
Yeah. It's a strange thing. I think I've talked about this before on the show, but I think for some people it's about the money, but it's more than that. They really enjoy ripping people off. There's something about it that they love doing. I don't know. That feeling when they take somebody's money and they know they've just stolen from that person and that person doesn't even realize it, you know? I won't go on the tangent again, but a really good book on the topic that kind of, I don't know, I found it very fascinating was Confidence Man by Herman Melville, which is about a confidence man, a con man. Con man, short for confidence man. But I think I've already gone on that tangent before on a previous episode, so I don't want to do it again. But another interesting accolade or, I don't know, innovation, I guess. I don't think he invented this one either, but Bernie's company was one of the earliest to use something called payment for order flow. A lot of people call this a legal kickback scheme. Some people say it's good. Some people say it's bad. Again, this is a whole other episode. There's a whole can of worms. I don't want to get into that. But basically, this is when a market maker pays a stockbroker for routing trades through them. So Bernie's company, his job is to provide liquidity to the market. A broker's job is to try to find the best price possible for their clients. So when Bernie says, if you buy from me, I'll give you a little bit of a kickback there to get more of the order flow, that's a little bit of a conflict there. How can you get the best price for your client when somebody's bribing you to use their particular order? It's questionable. And this is, if you've ever traded on some of these places, these brokers that don't have commissions, back in the day, they used to have, you kids don't know about this, but back in the day, stock trading used to have commissions for retail. If you went to buy shares of a stock, you would pay anywhere from $5, that was in the very low end, that was like Scottrade and a couple of other disruptors were charging $5 commissions per trade, and that was insanely cheap, all the way on up to $20, $30, even $50, depending on who you were going with. And that's because those stockbrokers have to make money somehow. They don't make very much money just holding your stocks. They make a little bit on that. I won't won't go down into the weeds on all that, but they got to make a lot of money to stay in business. So the way they did that was commissions. That way, you know, you trade, they make a little bit of money on that. And, you know, if you think about the money involved, you're going to invest $1,000, $2,000 or $5,000, whatever it is you're putting in, small time stuff that retail investors do, $5, $10 commission, not that big of a deal, you know? So it's, mm-hmm. it's not as bad as it sounds. These days, if you trade on like Robinhood or somebody like that, it's commission free. How yeah. can they possibly stay in business without charging commissions? Well, payment for order flow. That's how they do it. So there is still a commission. You just are not aware of it. You know, kind of like if you're not paying for it, then you are the product kind of a thing. But again, that's a whole other episode. So we won't really get into that too much other than to say that it is still a thing. And Bernie was one of the first people to do it. Again, not surprising knowing his background. He was really good at some stuff. You know, the guy wasn't completely useless. He was actually good, like we said earlier. But all right, so he had a lot of ties to a lot of things. He was part of the NASD, or the National Association of Securities Dealers, and was eventually their chairman. You might know yeah. these guys by their modern name, which is FINRA. Yes, that FINRA. Mm-hmm. Let that sink in. Okay, just keep that in mind as we're going through this episode. This guy was at one point the chairman of FINRA. I don't want to go into what FINRA is too much, but just a quote from Wikipedia, FINRA is, quote, is the largest independent regulator for all securities firms doing business in the USA. FINRA's mission is to protect investors by making sure yeah. the U.S. securities industry operates fairly and honestly.
I mean, there's a reason why he was investigated so many times throughout his career and then, you know, still didn't get in trouble until the end, of course. And, you know,
yeah.
but once the end came, I mean, we'll talk about all that later, but like, yeah. there was no avoiding the end basically once it happened.
Right.
Yeah.
We'll get to that at yeah. the end.
Yeah.
But it wasn't just him that was involved in things like this. His family members who were part, his family was part of his business. Mm-hmm. They were also involved with organizations like this. For example, he had several family members who were involved with SIFMA, or the Security Industry and Financial Markets Association, which is, quote, a nonprofit trade association that represents securities brokerage firms, investment banking institutions, and other investment firms. You're like, the hell is that? What do they do? What exactly do they do? Well, here's another quote. SIFMA's political action committees gave $421,000 in political contributions during the 2020 election cycle. Okay, so that's what it is, basically. It's an organization to bribe politicians for Wall Street, basically. So he had several family members on the board and various positions on that group as well. For example, his brother, Peter, and his niece, Shayna, were on the board. Bernie also served on the board and was actually chairman of its trading committee. The irony is just killing me here. It's just insane.
Yeah.
He was also a founding member of the DTCC, the Depository Trust and Clearing Corporation, which automates, centralizes, standardizes, and streamlines processes in the capital markets. I won't go into them too much, but they are a very, very important part of the stock markets. So he's got very important positions of power. And like you were saying, ETA.
Extremely influential.
He was extremely influential. And that might be why he got away with this for so long. You know, he's not going to investigate himself. He already mm-hmm. knows what he's doing, you know? Like, you hear these stories about people who met him and, you know, he was basically a celebrity. Like, oh, I can't believe I met him at the country club and it was so cool. I met this celebrity there. He was a rock star, you know, until he wasn't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And well, and also, like, a lot of the people that decided to invest with him, he would play these mind games. Like at first he'd tell you, oh no, I can't take your money. You know, I'm dealing with too much right now. And then he'd call you back sometime later and say, you know what? I mean, if you want to, I guess I could help you out a little bit. you know, so that would make people want to invest even more money that they originally even, you know, more than they originally planned on and what have you. But I guess the guy was very good at manipulating people, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And he knew how to play that game, you know, so like, he would play that game with everybody, even with elite rich people from Europe and from the United States and even like royalty from Europe and stuff. I guess there was a lot of people that were investing heavily in his asset management company, you know?
Yeah.
It was, the guy seemed to be a master manipulator, really.
For sure. Yeah. It was seen as an exclusive fund. There are some, there's a lot of hedge funds or big investment funds where they don't take, like, I can't get in there. They're not going to take my money. You need like a lot of money, like $1 million plus to put into these funds. And it's not easy to get in. And that's what he did. He cultivated himself as a very exclusive investment group.
Mm-hmm. A big part of his deal was being exclusive. And if you had the opportunity to invest, then you were being, you're lucky to be able to invest with his firm, you know?
Right. So that, and part of the reason for that too, is that the returns that he was able to get, you know, as quote unquote returns, but he got really good returns for his clients, like consistently good returns. Some might say suspiciously good returns.
A little bit. Yeah. And it didn't seem to matter what the market did. He always made returns. Like he never lost. He rarely lost money, like month to month or like year to year. Definitely not, you know?
Yeah. I think I saw there's only 7 out of the entire time he was doing this. He only reported a loss for like 7 months. You know, we're talking about decades of trading. That's unheard of. It's ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. There's very few people who can post these numbers, and he wasn't posting crazy numbers. That's part of the reason why he was so successful. A lot of Ponzi schemes will do like 20% annual return and then they run out of money. Because you can't keep that going for too long. He only did like 10% annual return. I know that doesn't sound that crazy, but that's
pretty crazy. But it's consistent. He was very consistent in those numbers, right?
Yeah. There's only a very small handful of investment managers who have been able to post numbers like that or better. Like, for example, Peter Lynch, he averaged something like 29% annually, which is just insane. He's one of the rock stars of, you know, of investing. I think he worked for Fidelity's Magellan Fund, you know. He was an absolute superstar, but he actually... Hold on. Did I feed the dogs? I don't know.
Oh, fuck it. Feed them again.
Yeah, who cares? Right. Beer They're break, small guys. Dogs. Beer break. Sorry, I gotta go feed the dogs.
What kind of beer are you drinking?
Some Racer 5.
Oh, nice. Good stuff.
Good stuff
right there.
All right.
Edit.
Let me put a marker. I'll be right back. All right. So where were we? Let's get back to the show. All right. So that's just like a little bit of background information on who he was and what he did. Now let's get to a little bit more of the details. He hired his brother, Peter, as a senior managing director. Peter's daughter, Shayna, as a rules compliance officer and lawyer for the company. And his own sons, Mark and Andrew, and his nephew, Charles Weiner, worked in the Weiner.
I prefer Weiner.
I after E or whatever, worked in the trading department. So his family, this company was stacked full of his family. And we'll get into that a little bit later, you know, theories on that. But nobody knows exactly when the Ponzi scheme started. Bernie said he didn't start it until the 90s, but there are some witnesses who went on record saying, no, I managed this crap for him starting in the 60s. So just think about that. Let that sink in. This Ponzi scheme was running since the 1960s in all probability. That's a good run. He didn't collapse until 2008. And then even then, it wouldn't have collapsed without the global financial meltdown or the, you know, subprime lending mortgage and the collapse of Bear Stearns and AIG and all that shenanigans, which, you know, don't get, you think this guy's a crook. We'll do an episode on the 2008 meltdown. It's on the list. We'll get to it. Believe you me, we will get to that because Do you think this guy robbed people? He's got nothing on, anyways, we'll get to that at some point. But so nobody knows exactly when it started, but it probably in the, you know, in the 60s. He said his strategy for making these gains was basically stock picking and market timing with a little bit more complicated stuff sprinkled in. A lot of experts don't believe him, but here's a quote, what he said on one of the ways. There's several quotes you can find on like what he told people his strategy was, but here's one quote. Typically, a position will consist of the ownership of 30 to 35 S&P 100 stocks, which are basically like your blue chip stocks, most correlated to that index. The sale of out of money calls on the index and the purchase of out of the money puts on the index. The sale of the calls is designed to increase the rate of return while allowing upward movement of the stock portfolio to the strike price of the calls. The puts, funded in large part by the sales of the calls, limit the portfolio's downside. What does all that mean, ETA?
I have no fucking clue.
It's a bunch of techno babble. It doesn't matter what it means. You know why it doesn't matter what it means? Because he didn't do any of that stuff. He just took their money and put it in a bank account. That's it. He just put it in a bank account. He didn't do any of that crap. He just came up. He would say this stuff to rich people. And if you didn't know anything about any of this stuff, it would sound, this guy's got a reputation. What are you doing, Agent Ether? Agent Ether is saying hi.
Hello.
If you didn't know anything about any of this stuff, you're just an average person and you don't know what a put or a call or an out of money or in the money or what any of this stuff is.
Options and stuff you can put on stock.
Yeah, he's speaking a foreign language, but you know the guy's smart about this stuff. So you go, well, that sounds very complicated. It sounds good to me. Here, take my money, you know?
He had built such a reputation also, like at a certain point where like people just like they didn't even question him about anything because he had returns that were, you know, profitable, and people just like he's like they looked at him as like an expert, an insider, you know, that like, hey, if I get in with this guy, then I'm gonna make money. Like there's no ands, ifs or buts about it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So he had created that reputation at a certain point where people just didn't even question him, you know?
There were a couple of stories about people who questioned him about his strategy in detail, saying, okay, that sounds great. How do you do that specifically? And he would stutter and couldn't really answer about the details of those strategies. Those are some fairly complex strategies.
He would sidetrack and say that it's like a proprietary plan he has. He can't reveal what he does because he doesn't want anybody else to steal his ideas. And
yeah, he couldn't answer it though. So there was a couple of people who said, yeah, we knew he was full of shit because he couldn't tell us what he was doing. You know, if a client's coming to you with hundreds of millions or in some cases over $1 billion to invest, you bet your ass they're going to want to know what you're doing with their money. You know, they have every right to know, you know?
I would want, if I'm going to invest that kind of money, I would want detailed information of exactly what I'm sinking my money into. You know, I would want to be, give some kind of reassurance. I would want some kind of reassurance, you know, to know that I'm not going to just be throwing away this money, you know? I'm not a big risk taker. You know what I mean? Maybe some people are. There are a lot of people are really gamblers and stuff. I'm not a gambler. If I'm going to invest any kind of substantial kind of money, you know, then I would want to know what the hell I'm putting my money into. So yeah, I would ask questions. Maybe some people, because he had this reputation, you know, maybe they just were like, well, fuck it. This guy's the go-to guy. I'll give him all this money because he seems reliable.
Right. Yeah. And it's, even if just buy and hold can be very risky for, you know, if you don't know what you're doing, you can lose a lot of money doing that, depending on what you do. So this is why people with substantial assets would trust him, because he got such good, reliable returns for so long. Even when, like you said, even when there was a market downturn, he still made money, which not easy to do. Uh-huh. Not that easy to, when the market takes a 30% dump and you're still ahead by 5-10%, like that's pretty unusual. Not unheard of. Some people are able to do that, but it's not typical, you know? All right, so let's get into it occurs to me people may not actually know what a Ponzi scheme is, because that's what we're talking about here. That's what Bernie Madoff was doing. He was doing a Ponzi scheme. It's a form, here's a quote, "It's a form of fraud that lures investors and pays profits to earlier investors with funds from more recent investors." So in other words, like I said, he didn't invest in anything. He just put the money into a bank account, which is wild. Just wild. Mm. So he puts this money into a bank account. You know, he pays bonuses to people. He takes some of it for himself. He gives some of it to friends and family. But by and large, he just puts it in the bank account. And when people ask for their money back, he just gives it to them out of the bank account. And he would do things like, because he's not actually trading, he would get like modified software that could like backdate trades. So basically he would falsify trades and like put timestamps and stuff on the trades to make it look like he had done those trades. But in reality, hold on. What are those goofballs doing over there? But
they're getting crazy.
Yeah, they're going nuts over there. But he wasn't actually doing these trades. And some of the trades that he'd backdated were, hold on.
is that Buddy?
Yeah, he's going nuts over there.
He's getting all crazy. Yeah. Establishing his dominance.
I don't know. I think he's just trying to play or something. But yes, because he wasn't making any actual trades, he would go to the past and choose a stock and say, oh, I bought this stock on this date and then it went up and I sold it on this date to justify his returns so he could show returns to people. But he would do that by backdating stuff. And some of the backdates were he would backdate it on like a weekend or something like that. And the stock market, not open on the weekend, guys. So he did make some mistakes like this. It's absolutely insane that he didn't get caught ever.
Well, that's the kind of mistake also. Like if you knew anything, that you wouldn't make that mistake. Like you already know it's not open during this period of time.
Yeah.
Why would you date it like that? You know, like that makes no sense.
It's how lazy can you get, you know?
I doubt it was him that actually, that made that mistake, you know?
Probably,
it's probably one of his employees that was just being lazy.
Yeah.
You know, trying just to get a job done.
And they had billions under management, so they had to fabricate an awful lot of these trades. In fact, that's maybe getting a little ahead of ourselves, but there were a couple of whistleblowers throughout the years who looked at his numbers and said, look, this isn't possible. I looked and in order, he says he traded, you know, $2 billion in Microsoft on this date, but there was only like $100 million in Microsoft traded that day. So it's not possible. Like there were huge discrepancies that were just ignored for decades, really. But so the Ponzi scheme is named after, he didn't invent it, right? It's been around for a long, long time, but it's named after Charles Ponzi, who famously used the scheme in the 1920s to steal about $20 million, which is somewhere in the ballpark of $300 million in today's money. He stole a lot of money back then. And he had a scheme using like stamps of all things. That's a whole other episode. We won't get into it, but that's a whole other crazy story. But it's Ponzi scheme is named after an actual guy that used it. And Bernie was doing pretty much the same thing, just with a different flavor of it, you know? And the idea is that, you know, an investor gives you money and you pretend that they have returns. And when they ask for their money, you pay them out with money from newer investors, right? And for example, Ponzi, people would give him money. And then the next month he would give them like a 50% return or something insane like that. And at first it probably cost him some money to get this started. But when people caught wind of his incredible returns, people were just flocking in, just throwing money at him. And, you know, he had more money than he knew what to do with. He kept his records on 3x5 cards, apparently. So
really?
He was not that well organized. But anyways, that is peanuts compared to what Bernie Madoff was up to, which was in the billions, orders of magnitude.
Well, wasn't it estimated eventually to be somewhere around like $1 million of total money that had been invested and mishandled?
You cut out there. The number changes a little bit depending on how you want to calculate it. And the fact is that because of the way it was done, we're not entirely sure what the exact number is, but I've seen figures up to 65 billion, somewhere around there.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if that's what you said, but.
It was, yeah. 65 billion was one of the highest estimates I had seen, or was the highest estimate.
Yeah, that's a lot. I mean,
it's a shit ton.
Maybe getting ahead of ourselves here again, but when he was convicted, I read that the court sentencing guidelines only went up to 400 million because probably they never expected anybody to even get to 400 million because that is so much money. It's an insane amount of money. 65 billion. That
holy
just
shit.
Just think about that. That's a lot of money. Well, it's a lot of cheddar. A lot of his targets were actually charities, because I guess charities had a 5% payout rule, it's called. I don't know exactly what the details are, but I guess charities only took 5% or required to take But anyways, for every $1 billion, he only had to pay $50 million out a year. And at that rate, he could keep the ball rolling indefinitely, even on current funds, let alone when he had new funds coming in. So that gave him a really solid basis to operate from. Of course, he took money from private individuals as well, but that was a big chunk of his money was from charities. And also, what a piece of shit, you know, stealing from charities. Oh my God. This guy had no shame whatsoever. This guy was just an absolute piece of crap.
Well, and a lot of people that he stole money from that were like some of his close friends, like, you know, he would go to like different churches or synagogues, what have you, getting good with these people. It's been said that he was a very, he had an infectious personality of sorts, and like he could hold a good conversation, even though some people say that, like, you know, if you asked him about certain things, he would kind of clam up and not want to talk about it, like specifics as far as his investment strategies and stuff, you know. But when he's hamming it up with people that he wants to have as investors, what have you, I guess the guy was a very likable guy. A lot of people thought that he was, you know, a good friend of sorts, you know, and they decided to invest with him, and he just completely ripped him off.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of these people that we're talking about here in this instance, like they lost a lot of money, but they weren't the kind of people that it didn't ruin their life. Once everything kind of like took a shit, you know, there was a lot of people that had invested heavily that, you know, couldn't afford to lose this money, you know, that they really, really got screwed and lost all sorts of, you know, like property and stuff like that. And
lost their houses,
lost their houses,
everything.
Yeah. Lost their way of life. You know, like they went from being somewhat comfortable to really not knowing how they're going to make it, you know?
Yeah.
It's really sad.
Not everybody that he ripped off was like a Jeff Bezos type, right? Mm-hmm. Probably his victims were all fairly well to do, but even so, just like, I think a lot of people might have the attitude of like, well, they're rich anyways, they can afford to lose it. But I mean, imagine that you start a company, you become successful and you earn $10 million. And then, you know, that you've won the lottery, so to speak, you've achieved your dreams, everything you ever wanted in life, you won the game of life, that's it, you're great. And then it turns out that no, all of this that you worked decades to build up, it's gone just overnight, boom, it's gone. I can't even imagine.
You made the mistake of investing a hefty portion of that wealth that you had accrued into this guy's business, you know, or this guy's asset management business, you know, and then all of a sudden you find out it's all gone.
Yeah.
You basically just threw all your money away. You know, like it there's nothing you can do to get it back. Nothing. It's just gone, you know?
And yeah. It's gone.
That was like your retirement seed, you know, like that was like what you were planning, like what you were planning on leaning on once you really retired and just try to be comfortable, you know, and not have to work or nothing like that, you know?
Sorry, I dropped my mouse there. But no, yeah, totally. There's one interesting thing about this case was that Bernie Madoff was Jewish and he targeted a lot of Jewish people. Some of them said they trusted him because, you know, he would meet them either at like a religious function or at like a country club or something. But he was sort of in the club, right? So they trusted him because he was Jewish. And there's a specific term that somebody came up with this, but it was a strange case where he was targeting a specific group of people as like his core victims. Of course, as it grew, it became much, much larger than that. And by the end, he had feeder companies or groups all over the world who would find rich clients everywhere, South America, North America, Europe, all over the place. And they would feed him clients. And in return, he would pay them large commissions for that money. So at some point it was global, but it just started off with him targeting, he would look for people at country clubs on Long Island and Palm Beach, and, you know, specifically Jewish people. And there was quite the fallout from those communities, particularly Palm Beach. A lot of people from that area put their money with him, and he basically stole it all.
Yeah.
Pretty crazy stuff. Like I said, some people ran the numbers and they were very suspicious of his math. They said, this just doesn't line up. It's not possible for him to get the gains that he's saying the way he's saying that he got them. It's just the math just doesn't work. Math does not lie, right? So people believed that he was either front running clients. I talked about that during high frequency trading, but it's possible for a market maker to front run clients. Basically, if somebody sends a big order, let's say a $10 million order to buy or sell stocks, the market maker can buy or sell stocks ahead of that order and then resell them to that customer for a small profit, maybe just a couple pennies a share, but that adds up, you know? So some people thought that in order to achieve these gains, he was actually front running. And then other people just straight up thought he was doing a Ponzi scheme because they thought even front running couldn't account for how much money he was making. Now, again, we're talking about 10% doesn't sound like a lot, but when you're talking about 10% of billions of dollars, you know, you're
a lot.
You're going from, when you're trading in the market, think of it as like there's a swimming pool, right? And somebody who's a retail investor, they're throwing pieces of dust into that swimming pool, no ripples at all, right? Somebody who's considered like a whale investor, somebody with millions of dollars, who might put in, you know, 100,000 here, 100,000 there, they're throwing pebbles or rocks. Bernie Madoff, with billions of dollars under management, he would have been like an elephant jumping into the swimming pool. In other words, anytime he transacted, there would have been evidence of that in the market. The market would have shifted based on the size of his transactions, but there was no such evidence of his transactions having any effect whatsoever on the markets, not at the, you know, dust level, pebble level, elf, no level at all was he affecting the markets. So that was a big red flag to certain people who were critical of him. But just like we've seen in other cases like Enron, people don't want a winner to lose. They want to cheer for the winner, you know? How many sports teams, you know, the successful ones have, well, so successful sport teams have a lot more fans than the losing ones, you know?
Of course, naturally, yeah.
You always got your underdog lovers and stuff like that, but I mean, nobody wanted him to fail and people didn't want to be critical of him. You know, there were people that reported him to the SEC and the SEC was like, meh, I don't know, you know? So yeah, the math didn't add up and his returns were basically impossible. Now, there were a few investigations over the years because, like I said, people did report him to the SEC and other places. For example, the SEC investigated him 16 times. 16
yeah.
times.
And found nothing.
Nothing, no.
Pretty much the yeah. whole time, which to me looks like they weren't really looking. Really. Well,
the investigations were either comically incompetent or they just weren't really investigating him because they did not even check his stock transaction records, right?
Well, they definitely never went to the 17th floor in the lipstick building. That's yeah. for sure. You know?
Yeah. They didn't look at his records because he didn't have any, so he had records that he fabricated, but if they bothered to check those records, it would have been apparent that those were fraudulent. Like it doesn't take a genius to figure out that when you're trading on a day where there's no trading, that's probably, you know, or when, you know, he's buying more stocks than were actually sold or transacted, that just, there's so many red flags that would have been very apparent to an investigation.
Well, I even remember hearing a story of during one of these investigations, they there was records that were requested about, you know, like certain trades he had made, what have you. And then he called down to whatever floor it was where he had employees that were supposed to have the records, but basically he had them fabricated there on the spot at that very time.
Yeah.
And they printed out all these papers, you know, of records, mm-hmm. you know, and they even had to put the papers like in a freezer to cool them down because they were hot off the printer, literally hot off the printer. So they knew if they just presented these right away, then they'd be like, whoa, this paper's hot. Like you obviously just printed this out. And so not only did they put it in the freezer to cool it down, but they also like tossed it around, you know, like a ball or something like that. And like they manipulated these papers a bunch to give the appearance that it had, you know, had some wear and tear on it. You know what I mean?
Step on it a few times.
Yeah. So that's kind of ridiculous.
Yeah. They weren't looking that hard.
Yeah. But if you're going to do something like that, I mean, I guess you got to put in a little bit of effort, right?
Yeah. You got to pretend a little bit. Yeah.
They put that little bit of effort in. Good for them. You know what? Good for them.
Yeah.
You know, they passed the scrutiny, I guess. The little bit of scrutiny.
If you want to call it that.
Yeah.
There's another case of shenanigans. A dude named Eric Swanson, who worked for the SEC, was investigating them. During the investigation, he started getting a little romantic with Shayna, and they ended up actually getting married.
Really?
Yeah. So that goes to show you how serious was this investigation. If he starts dating one of the people he's investigating, you know,
that was his niece, right? If am I mistaken?
That was Bernie's niece. Yeah. Bernie's niece. Yeah. But she worked for the company. She was their lawyer. And
yeah,
he's like, that's just, can you imagine a criminal investigation where like a detective's investigating a murder suspect and actually ends up marrying them instead? Does it happen? And I don't know.
Crazier things I'm sure have happened, but it is very suspect.
Like, yeah.
Does that become a conflict of interest? Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
It shows a huge lack of dedication on the SEC's part, but we know for a fact that the SEC is not like super into busting people. There's a lot of episodes we can do on financial stuff, but
are they the most moralistic agency in existence? No.
Well, as I demonstrated earlier, I don't think I didn't read that Bernie was actually part of the SEC, but he was part of regulatory agencies, and that's how it is in Wall Street.
He was an advisor to them at the very least.
The people on the boards of these things that are supposed to be investigating, they're the same people that they're supposed to be investigating. It's wild. That's why
it's no wonder why some things get swept under the rug.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like,
and there's some cases where I'm like, why did that person go to jail for doing the same thing that everybody else is doing? Like, for example, Martha Stewart, who like she was doing basically like insider trading or whatever, but it was like, it wasn't that big of a deal. She was doing the exact same thing that everybody else is doing. My theory on that one is that she was mean to somebody and she pissed off the wrong person or something. And they're like, all right, well, fine. If you're going to give me attitude, then I'm just going to throw the shoe at you or whatever. Slap on the hand or whatever it was they did it. But I was like, dude, why go after her specifically when everybody's doing it? I don't know.
Yeah. There are bigger hogs out there in the pasture. You know what I mean? I can't imagine she was that big of a deal where you had to, throw the book at her. You know what I mean?
I'm not super familiar with that case. Maybe I should put it on the list. I don't know.
Yeah, neither am I. I just knew it happened.
Yeah.
Something happened there.
But it's that case, like you said, it's a smaller amount, so it's not as interesting as cases like this. But anyways, Eric actually did misdirect attempts to investigate the company after he was romantically involved. And there's one point where there's like an email he sent to a supervisor saying, hey, I got to stop investigating these guys because I am actually dating this chick now. And the supervisor responded in the email, quote, I guess we won't be investigating Madoff anytime soon. It's like, okay, like that's it's that easy. All right, that's it, that easy. Okay.
Oh wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Interesting. There was a couple people specifically. There's a lot of people who noticed mathematical inconsistencies and reported them, but just a couple of people to mention of note. Edward O. Thorpe in 1991 found discrepancies. For example, Madoff said he bought 123 call options for Procter & Gamble on April 16th, 1991, but on the market for that day, only 20 options had been bought. So that was clearly not true.
Yeah.
Harry Markopoulos, a financial analyst, was asked to replicate Bernie's fund. That's a thing. If somebody makes a strategy that's successful, you're going to see a bunch of other funds or groups popping up to mimic that success, whatever it may be. There's all sorts of wacky investment strategies out there. If one of them pays off, you guarantee you that there are going to be imitators popping up very shortly thereafter. It's money. Why wouldn't they? If it's a working strategy. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
My personal favorite is there is an ETF. It's who's that guy? Jim Cramer. It's an anti-Jim Cramer fund or inverse Cramer fund. So
I don't know who that is.
They try to do the opposite of whatever Cramer says.
I remember Cramer from Seinfeld.
No. Jim Cramer is a TV personality who makes calls and stuff. He suggests people buy things and whatever. Of course, with the asterisk, this is an investment advice, blah, blah, blah. The few times I've actually looked at what he said, I've done the opposite and actually made money, you know?
Oh, really?
In very small amounts, you know?
Well, I mean, strike me as being maybe naive, but I don't think you're going to have any kind of advice that comes off from a TV show, whatever it was, that's going to make you a big bucks. You know, it's
yeah.
That kind of information doesn't people keep that close to their sleeve. You know, like it's
right.
You're not going to hear about those kind of like any really big investment you can make on TV. That I mean, it's just going to be more of a grandioso show that is going to entertain you rather than make you money. You know,
this guy was the real deal at one point. He made a shit ton of money trading the news, buying and selling options based on news that came out. You know, he got the news as early as he could, and he made a bunch of money on it, millions of dollars reportedly. If you want to see a really fun interview, though, look up John Stewart's interview of him. He basically ripped him a new a-hole because the problem is that he'll make these recommendations on stocks and people buy them and people lose money on this stuff. And we're not talking about people with a lot of money to lose. We're talking about people who are trying to build nest eggs and stuff, you know? It's very irresponsible.
I was actually very surprised to learn recently, I don't know how recent this happened, but it was news to me, that I guess Jon Stewart's now back on The Daily Show again?
Yeah, because it was so bad. So bad.
Well, oh yeah. Ever since he left, it was so bad, so bad.
But that's maybe a topic for the after hours. No, after hours. What am I, English?
Yeah.
The after hours.
I was just surprised to see that. That's all.
Yeah.
You know, once you mentioned his name, I was like, I remember seeing that. I was like, holy fuck, really?
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
It got so bad. Like the guy that replaced him, I used to like that show, but the guy that replaced him, the show turned into basically whining about Trump winning the whole show. Like,
Orange like, man geez, bad. Like, and I'm not a huge fan of Trump. I don't dislike him necessarily. Mm-hmm. I think he's better than Joe Biden, but I mean, why get into the weeds? This is not what the show is about. So let's not polarize ourselves like that.
Well, yeah, you know? But the whole point is like whether or not I agreed with him, it's not entertaining to just watch a guy whining about Trump for 30 minutes. It's just not.
Yeah.
He wasn't even making funny jokes. He was just whining. It's like, come on, dude. Well, at least be funny about it.
What was his name? Trevor Noah?
Yeah, Trevor Noah. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
He just wasn't funny.
He was a one-trick pony kind of in that way. You know, like I'm sure the guy has talent. Obviously, he got there for some reason, but I mean, he just the repetitiveness of the topics that they would cover was just it just got old real quick, you know.
I would have loved to see literally any of their other correspondents step up to host the show, whether it's Spantha B, Wyatt Snack would have been so good. Like any of those guys would have been great.
let's be honest, Samantha Bee was pretty fucking trash, dude.
I don't know. I thought she was funny.
I thought she was fucking horrible.
Oh yeah.
I thought absolute fucking trash, dude. No,
well,
she was even worse than him, I think.
Like maybe I'm wrong about that one. I don't know. John Oliver, I don't know. There's a lot of funny people working on that show that would have done a much better job, I think. But anyways,
yeah, John Oliver's trash too.
Let's not get too far into that. What are you talking about? He's funny. Get out of here. But
let's not get too far. That's my opinion. I'm sticking to it.
Yeah. No, that's all right. Hey, everybody's trash. Entitled to their opinion. But yeah, we don't like getting too political on this show because, you know, we like everybody to be welcome. You know, we want to talk about weird stuff. You don't got to be part of a particular political party to enjoy weird stories, you know? So
of course, no. Yeah.
That's why we try not to get too much in the weeds on that kind of stuff. Cause we, you know, I think it's too far afield for what I want to do for the show, but anyways,
it's not what we're about.
Yeah. Back to Harry Markopoulos, who was a financial analyst. He was asked to replicate Madoff's returns in a fund. He looked at Madoff's records or strategies for 4 hours. And after 4 hours, he determined that Bernie was a fraud. It took him 4 hours.
From what I heard in one of those interviews, it didn't take that long for him to figure out that he was a fraud. It took him 4 hours to figure out it's a Ponzi scheme.
Right.
Like, he learned very fast. All this information I'm looking at is very suspect. There's definitely some fraud going on here. And then as he looked into it more, he was like, all right, this isn't just fraud. This is something more. This is a Ponzi scheme. This is big, you know?
Yeah. And he sent his notes and his research and, you know, an explanation and whatever. He didn't just call up the SEC and say, hey, I kind of suspect this is the case. He actually gave them proof. And the SEC did absolutely nothing about it.
And he did this multiple times.
Yeah.
He sent reports to them multiple times. I think it was 2001, 2003, 2006, 2007. Like, I might be wrong about that. I know that he sent multiple reports.
Yeah, he did. Yeah.
Time and time again. And time and time again, they were just, I guess it fell on deaf ears, you know?
Yeah. And by this time, he
ended up being right.
By this time, the fund was the largest private equity management fund in the world.
Yeah.
Largest in the, let that sink in, you know, largest it's in the crazy. World. The guy who used to be the chairman of FINRA or whichever one it was, you know, he also reported it as a side note to the Wall Street Journal, who of course also ignored it. To be fair, the Wall Street Journal, their job is not really to expose fraud. That's not really what they're about, as far as I understand, you know.
I mean, if it comes to light, they should report on it at least though.
Yeah.
Which they did, and eventually.
Eventually. But they were not going to break a story like that. Not a chance they're going to take a risk like that.
Yeah.
Which I can understand that, because that's an awfully big bridge to burn, you know? Yeah, there's going to be, and it's not just Bernie, it's all of his buddies, all of the influence he has. That would be suicide for the Wall Street Journal to do that. But anyways, he found 30 red flags that he pointed out. For example, Bernie's returns were basically a straight 45 degree line upwards, just like this, a straight line that if you graphed his returns over time, it was just like that, just a 45 degree. And anybody familiar with any of this stuff will know that that doesn't exist ever long. At least we're talking long-term. We're talking over decades. That's not a thing. Go look up any market, go look up the S&P 500, the Dow Jones, go look up the, you know, the NASDAQ, whatever. Take your pick, look up anything. You will never see a 45 degree line. It's just not possible. So that's one of the red flags. We won't go over all 30 of them, obviously. That'd be a little ridiculous. But so anyways, there was multiple people who did this sort of mathematical stuff and proved that there was some kind of shenanigans. Again, won't go into all of them. It'd be sort of, you know, beating a dead horse. So let's get to the end here. This went on and on and on and on, and it wasn't until the 2008 financial collapse that he finally, the Ponzi scheme was undone.
Fell, fell apart because everybody wanted their money back.
And, yeah, everybody was in a state of panic, and everybody's like, look, I'm sorry, I need this money because I got to move it over here or whatever. Shit's hitting the fan. I don't want to be in the markets right now anyways. So everybody wanted their money back. And of course, it just wasn't there because of the scheme he was doing. It's not like he put the money in the bank and let it sit there. He would pay out other investors with the money from newer investors. He would pay bonuses. He paid millions, tens of millions to his friends and family for, like, you know, loans or, you know, business expenses, whatever. So the money just wasn't there. He had like a few hundred million or something, but not 65 billion or whatever it was that he was supposed to have. So,
oh, nowhere near.
Yeah. So at that point, it all started to collapse. And then he tried to scare up new money. He'd go, went and try to hit up a bunch of people for, you know, fresh investments or whatever. Hey, I got this new idea for this crazy new fund. It's going to make all kinds of new money. But nobody in their right mind was putting money into the markets at that time. The markets in 2008 were like, it was a mess. It was like a free fall. It was crazy. So people were not getting in. They were all afraid. So he couldn't scare up the money. And by the end of November 2008, he knew the game was over. The Ponzi scheme was basically collapsed at that point. He had one of his sidekicks, Frank DePasquale. He told him to cash out relatives and close friends out of the funds with all the remaining money that was left.
And hey, he confessed to his sons, right? And
yeah.
He actually, am I getting ahead of this a little bit?
Nope. That's what happened next, at least in my notes. And
started to usurp your information
in December. Go ahead with the, he told his two sons.
I think it was actually kind of really intelligent the way he did end up confessing. Basically, is he told his sons to basically go to the feds and turn him in, you know, which saved his sons
from
accusations and stuff. So I guess the guy did have some consideration for others around him. He wasn't just like he cared about his sons at least, you know.
Yeah.
So he went to his brother first and then his sons, from what I understand. And his sons are the ones that turned him in. And so that kind of alleviated, accusations that could have been brought towards his son. And even when he was, after he was convicted and stuff, I guess he's still up to his old games in the penitentiary. Well, was until he passed away, I guess.
Yeah.
Which was April 14th, 2021, was it?
I think something like that. Mm-hmm. I have it a little further down on my notes, but
let me look.
As the story goes, his sons had no idea it was a Ponzi scheme. They don't know. I don't know. It was a Ponzi scheme. And
I don't know, Rick.
When his father told him what it was, oh guys, it's a Ponzi scheme. It's all over. They immediately turned him into the authorities and did the right thing. You know, we're not going to take this $170 million in bonuses. We're going to turn you in right away. But if you remember, his sons were in charge of the trading. They were in charge of the trading aspect or the trading desk of his company. So there is zero chance they didn't know it was going. They were in charge of this shit and there was no trading activity going on. They had to have known about it. So this was just a scheme for basically Bernie knew that heads were going to roll. He knew that at the very least his head was going to roll. So like you said, this was his way of saving his sons, but there's not a chance his sons were not in on the scheme. They had to have known.
I believe full heartedly in that. Yeah.
Yeah. So they reported him to the authorities and he was arrested the following day. And it wasn't just Wall Street. Like I said, because he had all these feeder funds, the fallout was global. There was a lot of people all over the world who were sent to jail, but the money, they got some of it back, but not all of it.
Not much.
Bernie was worth a couple hundred million dollars and they got a little bit of that back, but we're talking about 64 billion more or less, give or take, you know?
Yeah.
Drop in the bucket. They didn't get hardly anything back.
Hardly a drop, you know?
Yeah.
It's nothing really compared to what he owed people.
Part of the fallout of this was several suicides that I found kind of interesting and questionable. One was Rene Thierry Magon de la Villachaux. I'm sure I'm saying that wrong, but
I wouldn't have done that good of a job of the pronunciation. I can tell you that.
French guy who was the of Access International Advisors LLC. He was found dead in his office in New York with a slit left wrist and sleeping pills in his system. There was no suicide note. And he was, I didn't look into it too closely, but from what I understand, he was involved with feeding clients to Bernie Madoff, right? And why would you take sleeping pills and slit your wrist? Like, I don't know. You're not going to jump off a bridge and shoot yourself in the head. It's kind of weird. Right.
Well, I don't know. Maybe double whammy, you know?
Yeah. But I no suicide note. The way I look at this is like, I think it's possible that if you cause somebody to lose $100 million, $500 million, somebody's got to pay, you know? An example must be made.
Yeah.
That cannot, you know, you cannot abide. The dude cannot abide that kind of shenanigans. Yeah. William Foxton, age 65, lost all of his money and his family's money, and he shot himself in a park. And that one, I think, probably was a legitimate suicide. Mark Madoff, the elder son, was found 2 years to the day after he turned in his father, on the exact day.
Yep.
Hanged in his apartment by a dog leash. No suicide note. Dude.
Could it have been possibly like erotic asphyxiation?
It sounds to me, because of the timing and the use of a dog leash, to me that sounds like somebody was sending a message, right?
If you're going to hang yourself, are you going to do it with a dog leash? Or, I mean.
Yeah. No, you're not.
Like most men, there are statistics out there that, you know, like when a man commits suicide, usually it's not by hanging or even slitting the wrist. You're probably going to shoot yourself in the head because it's fast, abrupt, and reliable, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
So, but yeah. Who knows? You know, I think it's suspect at the very least.
Dude, I think somebody was, you know, somebody's like, well, I can't get my money back, but you're going to lose your son, you know?
Well, yeah. I mean, while Madoff was going through a trial and stuff, like when this all first came out, there was like a lot of people that were like, you know, swarming around his apartment or wherever he was staying in New York. And they were saying like, hey, it's not too late, dude. You can still jump. You know, like they're like trying to like his death, you know, and I don't blame them. Some people lost their fucking ass, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't blame him. I would be pissed too. I don't know if I'd call for his suicide. Maybe I would. I don't know. It depends on how much I lost, you know.
But well, this
I tell him to jump, dude.
This guy was a coward. There's no way Bernie would have committed suicide. He's too much of a coward from my estimation. Sandra Weiner, sister. Well,
and also from what I understand, there's a lot of
What's up?
Huh? I guess there's a little bit of lag there.
Oh,
I've seen some interviews with psychologists and stuff that have kind of like cross-analyzed him and stuff, and they think that he is some kind of a psychopath because he doesn't seem to feel any remorse at all, basically for what he did.
Yeah,
he's never apologized for it. As a matter of fact, quite the opposite. Like he basically, said that what I did wasn't that bad. It really didn't hurt anybody. You know. Mm-hmm. Is not the truth.
No, he hurt a lot of people. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, you see like videos of him like getting yelled at by people and you can see he's kind of smiling, almost like he's enjoying it, you know? Like mm-hmm. he's kind of got this look on his face like, I fucked you. I got away with it too, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Like that was kind of how he looked. He didn't look remorseful at all.
No, not even a little bit.
Yeah. His sister, Sandra Weiner, and her husband were found dead in their Boynton Beach home, which was an apparent murder-suicide. The authorities provided no details on this. There's a lot of people surrounding him and his family that ended up dying after he got caught, you know?
Boynton and like Beach, I said, where the hell is that?
You what?
Is that in Florida? Boynton?
B-O-Y-N-T-O-N? I don't know. It's probably somewhere fancy.
yeah, probably. I'm not familiar with the name at all. So I was like, what the hell? That's kind of a weird name for a beach, but maybe not. I don't know. I assume it's in Florida.
Yeah. We'll say Florida. There's a lot of beach in Florida.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
But that was, that's another weird thing. The authorities didn't say, who shot who or what the deal was with that. They just said it was probably a murder suicide.
Not really.
No suicide note or anything like that again. So we have this pattern here where people involved are being made to pay because they're never getting their money back. And you got to think about the sums involved here. Billions of dollars.
Oh, yeah.
Somebody's gonna extract. I don't know. There's no proof of any of this. This is just what I suspect, looking at this wave of death surrounding him. You know, yeah.
To some, it may sound crazy, but I wouldn't be surprised at all if there had been people offed just because, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, for sure. Just because, well, you know, while he's in jail, they're like, okay, you're in jail, but we're gonna kill your kid, we're gonna kill your sister, like. We'll never get our money back, but we're going to make you suffer as much as possible.
Yeah. We're not going to get our money back, but we'll get something back.
Yeah.
You know, we'll make you fucking feel sorry for what you did, I guess. I don't know. Whatever.
Teach his grandmother to suck eggs.
Ren and Stimpy.
Yeah.
my favorite is the powdered toast man with X-ray nipple vision.
Yeah.
That's great. That show it was not for kids.
No, not at all.
Nickelodeon should have never made that for kids. There's too much adult humor there, you know?
So Bertie was sentenced on March 12th, 2009. He was sentenced to 150 years in jail, a $17 billion fine, and a lifetime ban from securities trading, which is sort of just like an extra middle finger, because it's like, dude, he's never getting out. Why would you even bother with that? Yeah. Just
150 years, too.
Like, yeah.
All right. They threw the book at him. They gave him the maximum sentence, from what I understand.
Yeah, they went full ham on his ass, I guess.
Which, to be honest, he deserved. He's the most egregious person that has done this kind of Ponzi scheme. You know, that, I mean, it lasted for decades, and the amount of money he was able to cheat people out of and stuff. He's probably the worst example of this, you know? So throw the book at him, you know?
Yeah.
Make him pay.
And he died in jail on April 14th, 2021.
Kidney failure, I think, right?
Yeah.
Is it kidney?
Yeah. Kidney failure. Yeah. He had some medical problems in general. I think, I also read he's having trouble with his lungs and stuff, but he was still somewhat of a celebrity in jail. People looked up to him because of the sheer size of his crime. He was sort of a celebrity in jail as well. So, I mean, but at least, you know, being a celebrity in jail is probably still not that great.
Well, I'd rather be a celebrity out of jail
than
in jail.
Yeah, you know, exactly. Like I've said before in the show, if you're going to do crime, go big, go real big. Even though he was eventually caught for the crime, he got away with it probably from the 1960 all the way to 2008. And
he had a long ride.
If it had not been for the 2008 meltdown, he would have probably still continued it, you know?
Yeah.
He probably would have never.
That's the basic reason why he got caught, is because that whole financial situation happened and people tried to draw their money back, and then they found out there was no money, you know, like,
and
it's gone.
They had the evidence to convict him. The SEC did. Other agencies did. Everybody refused to act against him. Like I said, if you're going to do crime, go big, real big, and you'll be fine.
He went big.
He eventually went to jail, but for most of his life, he lived like a king. It wasn't until the very end, you know? So it's kind of frustrating to know that you can steal this much from this many people for so long, and the agencies that are supposed to protect us don't, even when they have the evidence needed for a conviction. You know, it's just crazy, crazy wild case.
It's not just that they didn't have the evidence. They didn't look for so many years. They didn't even look into it far enough. They could have ended this far before it had ended. They just didn't put the effort in, you know, because he was such an influential individual and very well respected, that they just, you know, they figured, you know, why put the effort in, I guess. I don't know exactly what the reasonings are, but they obviously didn't do their due diligence, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I can speculate.
For sure.
One thing I suspect is that over there on Wall Street, it's all a bunch of crooks, thieves, and liars. So they don't want to catch one of their own. They're all doing stuff like this, yeah, you know?
Yeah, I kind of assume that same thing. It's like they don't want to ruin their own game that they're playing, you know? Right. So, like, yeah.
That's, I don't know. There's different ways of looking at it, but that's one of them. But all right, well, I mean, that's kind of all I had on this one. There's a lot more to this case. Like, we could easily do like 10 episodes if we wanted to get in on the weeds on all this stuff, like look at the details of the case. We could easily do 10 episodes, no problem on this one.
Oh,
easily.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for but, sure.
I think, you know, just a short summary of the case, which is what this was, is probably good enough for you guys to get the gist. And if anybody's interested, there are multiple documentaries. There are multiple books written. There's all sorts of ways that you can look in and get more information if you want to get more details on the case. But that's, in a nutshell, that's basically what happened with Bernie Madoff, the, you know, one of the biggest thieves in history. You know, he's called the biggest thief in history, but we haven't talked about TARP yet. So we'll get to that one. That was even bigger. But that's a topic for another time. So, all right. Well, thank you guys so much for listening. If you enjoyed the show, you can really help us out by suggesting the show to your friends, leaving us a good review wherever you listen to podcasts, and hitting the subscribe and like, and the notification bell. And also, if you got any questions, comments, thoughts, did we get anything right? Did we get anything wrong? Let us know in the comments down below, and we will get back to you when we can, hopefully. All right.
Sweet, dude. Keep that shit strange.